Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Rebecca McKinnon is Senior Fellow at the New American Foundation, where she conducts research, writing and advocacy on global internet policy, free expression and the impact of digital technologies on human rights. A fluent Mandarin speaker, Rebecca is a former CNN journalist and she headed the CNN bureaus in Beijing and later in Tokyo before leaving television and co-founding Global Voices Online, an international citizen media network. She serves on the boards of the Committee to Protect Journalists and the Global Network Initiative and is considered a leading expert on Chinese internet censorship. Her first book, Consent of the Network, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom, was published in the UK on 16th February by Basic Books. Rebecca, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks very much.
So, very early on in the book, you ask the question, how do we make sure that people with power over our digital lives do not abuse that power? Now, we've had a few guests on the show last year, Yevgeny Morozov was one, Heather Brook was the other, both taking sort of contrarian perspectives on what the internet does for people's freedoms. Where does your book sit in that debate and how does it take the debate forward?
Yeah, well, where I sit is that, you know, you can argue that the internet is helping the good guys more than the bad guys, or you can argue that it's helping the bad guys more than the good guys, or you can argue it's making us stupid or it's smart or whatever. Yes, it's doing all of those things. It's empowering everybody. To me, what I think is the more important question is how do we ensure that the internet evolves in a manner that is compatible with democracy, human rights, and the kind of society we want to have? And my point is that you cannot assume that it's going to evolve in one way or another, that's going to favor one group or the other, and that people who use the internet, people who make software programs, internet engineers, companies, regulators, the general public, voters, all have the potential to shape how the internet evolves. And so we all need to get involved in trying to do our best to ensure that the internet evolves in a manner that is compatible with the kind of society we want to have.
You've identified corporations as being quite a large player in terms of the effect they might have on our freedoms online in the future. In fact, you say corporations are the sovereigns of cyberspace. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Right. Well, as citizens today, increasingly we depend on privately owned platforms, devices, and services for everything, not only for our jobs and our educations and our love lives increasingly and everything else, our social lives and our cultural lives, but for our political lives. And our relationship with government is increasingly mediated through these privately owned and operated platforms, devices, and whatnot. And so the power that companies play in shaping ultimately how free we are or how unfree we are is quite large. And unfortunately, companies, while they claim that they have obtained our consent because we clicked agree when we signed up for the service, the decisions they're making are largely commercial decisions. You know, what is going to make Facebook more compatible with advertising, or so on. So the whole question of what is in the greatest public interest, what is most compatible with democracy, what is most compatible with human rights, the rights of minorities, the most vulnerable people who use the internet, is not foremost on the minds of people running these companies. And sometimes these companies happen to be creating platforms that are very empowering, you know, and people are using Facebook and Twitter to challenge power in many places, using other digital tools. You know, people in Iran were mourning Steve Jobs' death because they find, iPhones to be very empowering in a way. And so these companies sort of have global constituencies and global supporters. But at the same time, they have tremendous power. You know, Apple is censoring its apps, not only at the request of various governments, but also based on the values of its own employees who are trying to create sort of a positive experience for users. And generally, the decisions they're making are much more narrow than the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or kind of what we would consider free speech rights. So this is a problem. And so it's a question of how do you hold companies accountable to the public interest without having the state take them over, which is not something I advocate, or, you know, demanding that you put every engineering or software decision to a vote of all the users or something.
Sure.
But how do you create mechanisms, and in a way just sort of movements, that hold those who wield power over our digital lives accountable and serve consequences on those who abuse their power against us or who facilitate the abuse of power against us? And that's what we need to figure out.
Sure.
As we spend more of our lives online and as more of society happens online, do companies, particularly the large companies such as Facebook and Twitter, become accountable in the way a state is?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're getting at? Are they actual states?
Well, you know, they cannot put you in jail physically. Mm-hmm. They cannot torture you physically. They do not tax you.
Mm-hmm.
One can take the analogy of states, I think. You can take it a bit far. They're not the same as physical nation states. They don't have armies. But at the same time, they are exercising a kind of governance. Right, as Professor Larry Lessig, who's now at Harvard, used to be at Stanford, founder of Creative Commons, wrote over a decade ago, code is law. You know, just as legislation passed by states affects and shapes what we can and cannot do in the city of London, the software code that software engineers are writing for companies and the network engineering decisions that engineers are making is shaping what you can and cannot do with your digital lives. It's a sort of governance. You know, the enforcement of terms of service, the way in which Facebook chooses to, you know, set a rule that you have to use your real name when you're using Facebook, and if you don't, they reserve the right to shut down your account. That's a form of governance. It's a private form of governance. Are they exactly the same as a nation state? No, obviously not, because we're talking about the digital world, and the digital world is different. But are they exercising a governance function? I would argue that they are. So therefore, if you want governance to be accountable to the governed, In our physical world, we evolved quite some time ago away from the idea that you just kind of put up with, you know, whatever king that you happen to be living under, and that it's considered normal to have higher expectations and to expect to be able to hold one's governors accountable, and that the power of those who are governing us must derive somehow, you know, derives its legitimacy from our consent. Now, you know, it's not a direct thing in modern nation state, but nonetheless, there is this link. And so the question is, how do we ensure that companies, not only in their pursuit of profits, but kind of begin to understand that it's in their long-term interest, that they will have more legitimacy with us, their constituents, and if we leave, you know, they don't have much to sell, or they don't have much of a business, but convince them that their legitimacy depends not only on making us delighted and, you know, convenienced and so on, but that they earn our trust and that they respect our rights. And so that's not going to happen unless we demand it. It didn't happen until it was demanded in physical space, rather, you know, violently. Hopefully we don't need to be quite so violent, you know, in digital space, but nonetheless, it doesn't take asking politely and just sort of, it requires a real movement and a real effort.
Well, this is one of the points that I found most interesting and also most knotty in the book. You say that we need a Magna Carta moment, which I think is just a brilliant demand, but as you alluded to just then, the power that we as users have is not the power as around the Magna Carta, the knights, you know, the landowners
right.
have
yeah.
there. It's not the threat of violence. It might be the threat of leaving services and not patronizing services, but actually that's really just a jumping off point for you in the book, isn't it?
Yeah.
Then you go on to sketch what internet governance looks like now, and it's actually quite a complicated picture.
It's very, very complicated. And actually, really, what I'm, rather than calling for a Magna Carta, and there's actually been quite a lot of people who've written various internet bills of rights and so on, and I think the most effective ones are those that are derived actually from Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other kind of very well-established documents that actually are technology neutral and apply pretty well to the digital space. And it's more about just saying human rights need to extend into cyberspace, and those who exercise power in cyberspace, in our digital lives, must respect and protect the rights that people have in those spaces, just as we expect them to do so in our physical space. But what I mean by the Magna Carta moment really is not that we need a Magna Carta, but more that we've arrived at a Magna Carta moment.
Right.
Which is to say, there was a point in time where everyone just sort of assumed that kings had this divine right to rule, and that was sort of how it was. And then, you know, I oversimplify slightly, but there was sort of a, you know, a gradual recognition amongst more and more people, you know, broadening throughout society, that the old way of organizing power and legitimacy and sovereignty just wasn't working very well for most stakeholders in society, and that it needed to be reorganized, and that the whole basis for the legitimacy of power needed to shift. It needed to be shifted, and took a lot of doing to shift it. And I think what we're recognizing now is that this notion of kind of consent of the governed, organized around a nation state, is not working so well when it comes to really protecting and serving the rights and interests of everybody who uses the internet around the world. Because, you know, you'll have one government. You know, government A passes a law that then affects global internet companies and has an impact on users around the world. And most of those people did not vote for government A, assuming government A was elected. And so there's an inability to hold that government accountable to the interests of most people on the network. Then you have the companies that are exercising this sort of global type of sovereignty, digital sovereignty, looser than a nation state, but nonetheless a type of sovereignty, I argue, a type of governance. And then you have all these other governments kind of seeking to exercise control over the internet in different ways. You know, the current sort of mishmash of systems and approaches to problems on the internet is just not working. We need to rethink it.
We've talked a lot so far about companies and whether companies, you know, private companies are functioning as states, but states and, you know, autocratic states are still major players in how the internet works. You bring up a lot of examples. The Ben Ali regime in Tunisia had an incredibly evolved internet surveillance and censorship system. Could you tell us?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that we're seeing, and not only with Tunisia, but say with China, is that authoritarian regimes can adapt and evolve. Sometimes they get overthrown, as in the case of Tunisia, but other times they don't. If you look around the rest of the Middle East and North Africa, the internet has been helpful in people mounting a challenge, but it has not resulted in many governments' fall, and many governments have done a much better job of managing and adapting and manipulating networks than people ever expected. And part of it just has to do with the fact that within a sovereign state, the internet service providers and the mobile phone networks are, of course, under that jurisdiction. Yeah. And so they will, of course, they're held liable for what their users are doing in that country by that government. And so if they want to continue to function, they have to assist the government in its policing.
There's a really haunting moment in the book where you're sat at the awards that the Chinese government give for, and I can't remember quite,
the self-discipline awards.
The self-discipline awards.
Yeah, and you know, this is the thing in China, that most people, I think, in the West, when we think of Chinese internet censorship, we think of the Great Firewall of China, so-called, and that's the mechanism that blocks Facebook and blocks Twitter and renders thousands of websites inaccessible from Chinese networks. But that's only the top layer. And most people in China are accessing the internet through platforms and services run by Chinese companies that most people in the English-speaking world haven't heard of, but with names like QQ and Sina and Sohu and Tencent and Baidu and so on. And these companies are held responsible by the government for everything their users are doing. And so they're required to exercise, quote unquote, self-discipline. And there's an award given out every year to the top 20 companies that do a, you know, better job than everyone else of policing their users and policing the content. And the year, 2009, the year I got into the ceremony, one of the recipients was a gentleman named Robin Lee, who is the CEO of Baidu, which is China's major search engine.
You don't make this link in the book, but as I was reading it, I wondered whether this was one potential future for democracies in the West online, if we don't get this fight right. Is that alarmist?
No, it's not. I mean, I actually, in some talks I give, this is one of those things where it's easier to do a slide than kind of depict in a book, and perhaps I should have said this more kind of overtly in the book, but I have this slide where I have sort of this round circle on the left, or on the, yeah, on the left, that says democracies, and a round circle on right that says, you know, autocracies. And then, you know, I say, well, most of us assume that the inevitable course of history is that all these authoritarian countries are going to inevitably, inexorably evolve to become democracies. But actually, you know, and then I showed the two arrows meeting in the middle, you know, another distinct possibility, if you look at what's going on right now, is that we could meet in the middle, that authoritarian states will feel a bit more free, or quite a bit more free, thanks to the internet, but it will still be impossible to organize an opposition party, as we see in China, without the usual consequences of going to jail. And we'll still have our democratic trappings, but we'll be a bit more manipulated, a bit more chilled, a bit more surveilled in unaccountable ways, and our liberties will be corroded, you know, kind of gradually, subtly, without our noticing.
I found the section in the book on, yeah, you mentioned China is mostly run by, China's internet is mostly run by internal Chinese companies. I found the section on the mention of the Iranian attempt to create a halal internet absolutely fascinating, one which would be in compliance with Islamic law, but also completely internally Iranian. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that's my immediate response to that was, well, that's no internet at all, really.
It's an intranet.
Yeah. Exactly. Is the global element necessary for a functioning internet?
Well, you can have a national intranet. Sure, that's possible. In fact, North Korea has done it for years. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, we keep seeing news about the purported halal intranet and the plans to create it, and we'll see kind of how that goes. They're going to have to get a lot of their core kind of services into the Iranian internet, which actually currently aren't. But you could technically, and the Chinese have a hybrid model where most people are using a domestic internet. All the critical services of all governmental services, all domestic corporate services, domestic media, and so on, are all hosted on computers inside China, interconnected through the domestic network. The international internet only comes into China through about 8 or 9 points, exchange points. That's heavily filtered. And there are actually places in China, there are some campuses where if you want to access the international internet, you have to pay, you know, some kind of per megabyte outrageously high thing, with the exception of certain whitelisted sites. You know, otherwise, just use the domestic internet. And that's, you know, we'll see how Iran does it, but they could do that, where they could have placed a great deal of restrictions on who can access the international internet, not cut it off 100%, but have it, you know, kind of slow down and restricted for most people, and just make it so difficult to use international websites. And if you allow enough investment into the domestic infrastructure, then you can make it work. The difference between China and Iran is that China's internet sector is heavily financed by the West. A lot of China's big internet companies are all listed on Western stock exchanges. And, you know, American venture capital is very active in China. You know, China Mobile is a huge international company. You know, Huawei and ZTE, big multinational companies now. Those companies are very much tied into Western capital markets in terms of getting their finance, which enables China to have the capital to set up its own infrastructure. Iran doesn't have the capital, and so you see things like, you know, there are certain government departments apparently where public information email addresses like a Yahoo account or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it's expensive to do. If you're going to do it well in a way that enables your domestic economy and your domestic education system to really benefit from the network and sort of control the extent to which people access the global internet, it can be done, but it requires a lot of capital.
You're listening to Little Atoms, and today we're speaking to Rebecca McKinnon, author of Consent of the Networked. You speak in the book about pitched battles going on not just in Iran, China, Tunisia, Rebecca, but also going on in the West, and a recent example of an OECD, is that right, report into an Internet Bill of Rights which civil society wasn't able to sign on to.
The OECD last summer kind of put together a set of principles for business and human rights on the internet, and civil society wouldn't sign on because there was too much mention of the responsibility of companies that smacked of liability, that smacked of self-discipline.
Right.
And it was in the name of protecting children and, you know, fighting intellectual property violation and all these things that Western governments tend to want to manage rather than political dissent or anything. But civil society was very concerned about slippery slope. Now, a kind of more lightweight and general set of principles actually came out at the end of the year after my book went to print that kind of put, you know, just set out principles at a much higher level without getting into the detail of companies' responsibility, which civil society has been much more supportive of.
But the battles around IP.
Yeah, and the battles around, you know, I mean, in the United States, we just had this huge fight around the Stop Online Piracy Act and its sister act in the Senate, which we managed to stop. And it took a tremendous amount of activism from a lot of people, and a lot of people sort of woke up for the first time realizing, wow, these people in Congress, what are they doing? You know, what are they doing to our internet? And got involved, started calling their representatives for the first time. And, you know, you had the internet industry rallying around it. But this is the example of many kinds of situations where in a democratic country, democratically elected representatives have some constituency that's quite important to them, that's crying bloody murder about some problem the internet has generated. Maybe it's intellectual property theft, if you want to call it that, you know, there's dispute. Maybe it's child pornography, maybe it's cybercrime, maybe it's cyber attacks by, you know, kind of theft of intellectual property by, you know, foreign agents or whatever. So there are a lot of constituencies who want government to solve these legitimate problems. And so then the problem is that a lot of times the solution that legislators grasp at, because it's kind of the most obvious and easy solution, is some form of censorship or some form of surveillance or some form of giving the state greater powers to interfere with networks in order to deal with the bad guys, but generally in a way that erodes due process and erodes accountability around if that power is abused, how do you keep it from being abused and how do you hold it accountable? And so the issue is, how do you kind of push back against that? And how do you say, look, you know, just as in real life, you know, if you're calling for the city of London to fight crime, there's a human rights compatible way to fight crime and there's a human rights incompatible way to fight crime. You know, you can have 0% crime in London at all times and you'll be Pyongyang, you know, and that'll be really wonderful. You know, and so there are trade-offs involved with ensuring that you solve a problem in a manner that's consistent with an open society in which people's rights are protected, and a democratic society where dissent is possible. And a lot of legislators and voters don't seem to have made the jump or the connection that just as in our physical space, it's about trade-offs, and you can't be absolutist, and you can almost never completely fix the problem without being totalitarian. Similarly, in our digital world, you can't just kind of fix it like you fix the TV or you fix the printer or something. It's just as in our physical world, you have to balance the solutions with the trade-offs. You have to get buy-in from all the people who have a stake in the result. You can't just kind of fix it.
But the temptation's always there, because if someone, as we saw in Egypt, it's possible to literally switch the whole thing off. And the temptation is always to look at it exactly as you say, in a technological sense rather than a societal sense or human rights sense. I mean, this is the internet is about technology rather than people who use, the people who are on it, or as a civil space.
Yeah.
I found that you were swinging between, in the book, saying, well, that this exposes a sort of failure of governments or a growing... There's a really compelling chapter where you speak about how the UN has failed to be able to credibly address issues around internet freedom, where I felt that you were saying, actually, democratic institutions are failing more generally. And then it seemed to be that actually maybe what the problem is that this is a special kind of problem. I wondered if you were resolved that actually you need a new system to address. I wonder if you were resolved one way or the other.
I tend to feel that there's not sort of one holistic global, here's the new structure for global internet governance that's just going to solve all our problems. And that it's really about, again, balancing power and finding a way to do it. And I guess there's another reason why I say we're at a Magna Carta moment and not at a English Civil War moment or at a American Revolution moment or at some Quit India moment or something. And that's because we're just at the moment of sort of recognizing that the old ways aren't working for us. And it's still only, that recognition hasn't really filtered out as broadly as it needs to, although it's, of course, happening faster at internet speed than 800 years ago in Magna Carta time. But we're at that moment where we're recognizing that things aren't working for us. And I guess I just don't feel that... I don't have the hubris or something to say, here's Rebecca McKinnon's, solution to sorting out the world. And rather, I think it's going to require a lot of work by everybody who has a stake in where this goes in sort of evolving politically. And it's going to be a collective effort, and it requires a global movement.
Well, this is the thing, and at the end you say there is much work to be done, and you make some suggestions, so I wonder if, and we're sort of quickly running out of time now, just what would you recommend listeners do as users, as citizens, to get involved with these issues and to make that
better? Well, first of all, just pay attention to what your elected representatives are doing about the internet, and make clear that your vote for them, your support, is linked to their making an effort, a sincere effort, to protect your civil liberties on the internet, in addition to keeping you safe and whatever else, and that's important to you. Because I think a lot of parliaments around the world, that message has not been sent. So I think that's one thing. The other is get more active in terms of, if there's products and services that you really love, Facebook or Google Plus or, a certain, BT or, whatever. But, get involved in letting, just don't sort of be passive and put up with whatever is shoveled at you. Be more demanding as a customer, as a consumer. Act like a constituent. You're a citizen of these spaces. I really think we need to organize user associations of these various services and get people sort of to engage in collective bargaining with the companies. So, and there are a number of, in any country, in the UK, you have the Open Rights Group, of course, and in the United States, we have the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and, they're sort of increasingly, throughout the democratic world, an analogous organization everywhere. People can get more involved either in supporting or just following these issues.
Brilliant. That's a perfect note to end on. Thank you very much, Rebecca McKenna.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.